Now, let me bring up two things that I want to talk about. Let's talk about where the tapeworm got backed up. Let's talk about successes. And I want to talk about two successes. One success is homeschooling. Okay. One of the best minds of our generation was John Gatto. And he's written great books, given great lectures on the educational system. Brilliant, wonderful man. And what John Gatto proved beyond a shadow of a doubt is one of the ways you get control of the who is you brainwash them early and you get control early through the educational system. And he's laid it all out. He's mapped it. He's proved it. You had a group of parents who said, you know something, we're not going to let you. We're going to school our kids at home. And when I tell you there was a war and the parents won, they just said no. You know, no. The answer is no, we won't. You can't. You know, this is a Gandhi civil disobedience. No. And the tapeworm got backed up. And if you look at the homeschool numbers, it's growing, growing, growing. It's made a huge difference. If you look at the average kid homeschooled in America, they are much healthier. They are much stronger. They have much better manners. They're much more knowledgeable. They're much smarter. Yes, there's a wide variation, but the numbers are growing. So homeschooling was a place where they lost, and they lost big.
I've always wondered about homeschooling. I don't have children, but it's inconceivable to me that I could have a child at home and teach him all these subjects all the way from grammar school up to high school. I mean, how do you do it? How do you have the time or the knowledge?
It's possible because, remember, you have not only curriculum and DVDs and computers, but a lot of the homeschoolers do cross-cutting functions where they go and do activities and education with other people. All the homeschoolers in the county get together and do here and go there and do this and bring resources in. So there's plenty that can be done.
Boy, it boggles my mind. I just can't imagine running a whole schoolhouse in my living room.
It's possible. The best educated human being that I ever met in my life, her parents were Indian. They lived in this country. And they moved every 6 months to a year so that they could keep her out of the school system. And she was free to just read and educate and explore. And she was the best educated person I've ever met, but so healthy intellectually and in spirit, and she loved to learn. There's a documentary that we did in the Salieri Report and Let's Go to the Movies called The School, which I highly recommend. It's about a school in Russia that's the most amazing school I've ever seen. The kids built the school, they run the administration for the school, they design the curriculum, and then they teach each other. So they have teachers, but they decide, okay, this month we just want to study physics, and we're going to study physics until we get tired of it. They are so intellectually ahead. You know, you have a 13-year-old sitting there explaining quantum physics, and they really know what they're talking about.
Yes, to have that freedom in an educational system, I could see how that would be
right.
Really liberating.
Right. Now, do I think that when you homeschool, if you have shared capacity, would it be much better? Or if you had a school like the one in Russia, would it be better? Yes. So I think any parent who's tried to homeschool the whole way would not disagree with that at all, because it can be very exhausting. It's too few people. But is it better than many of the public education experiences in this country? Absolutely, especially when it means you don't take vaccines. So, you know, I would rather be homeschooled, you know, in the living room, you know, through high school than have autism. The second place that they've gotten defeated is on vaccines. The swine flu vaccine failed.
Now, what year was the swine flu?
I think it was 2010.
Okay. Okay, so we're talking about recently.
Yeah. They tried unbelievably hard to get a mandated swine flu vaccination, mandated at the state level.
You mean mandated for the entire population?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I think Massachusetts even passed a law, or one of the sides of the House passed a law mandating it. And what happened was the healthcare provider said, no, no, we won't take it and we won't give it. No, we won't. And the pushback on the swine flu vaccination really failed. And it was a perfect example of where people very quietly came together and said, no. And now if you see how they're coming back, they're integrating swine flu vaccine with the annual flu vaccination. There's a now new push to require healthcare workers to be vaccinated, and they're pushing back hard because they failed so badly on swine flu, and you see them coming back again and trying lots of different things.
Now, what was it about the swine flu specifically that made the medical profession push back rather than these yearly flu shots that people get?
My guess is that it was much clearer, the physical damage that could be done. It was much more dangerous. And if you looked at what was going on, it was a lot less necessary in their minds. Now, I don't know enough to know if that's really true or not. But my understanding from healthcare professionals was they thought it was much more dangerous. You know, and I wrote an article about, I mean, I was one of the people who very early on came out with something very strong, because to me it was a very terrifying thing.
Well, there was a swine flu scandal decades ago. I remember my mother talking about it.
Right.
Maybe it was back in the 70s or something.
Right. A lot of people got hurt from that vaccination. The other place they failed is on gun control in America. And this is a very important financial issue, because if Americans gave up their right to carry firearms, I assure you, the taxes would rise astronomically very quickly. This is a financial issue. Same thing with the drones. I think the reason they want the drones is so that they can implement higher taxes. And many people do not understand the extent to which invasion of privacy with these digital systems or, you know, drones and gun control is really a financial issue, because it's a question of how can we steal more money from you in a way that you can't do anything about. I think most, if not all, of the school shootings and shootings like the congresswoman in Arizona were covert operations designed to create public support for gun control. And I think they've completely backfired. I think the population is too smart. They know something stinks. And it's particularly the Denver shooting with Holmes has backfired, and people have dug in, and it's making them want a gun even more. Because what they realize is, and if you look, two things, if you look at populations that have been relieved of their guns, there's a very strong historical evidence to say, you know, that's a very dangerous thing to do. You give up your guns, and the next thing you know, you're being genocided. That's number one. But number two, when an economy goes through a bad economic period, you are literally in danger from your neighbors. And giving up your guns puts the honest, you know, I get back to the honest people in a county, they become even more susceptible to crime and trouble from the, you know, the local slugs. So the American population has been unbelievably smart and impossible to trick on gun control. And, you know, my only fear is when they put up an entire network of drones, are they going to use the drones to try and force gun control? And my attitude is, if there's one thing you want to go down fighting on, that's it. Never give up the... And the only caveat to that is if you look at how much they've invested in entrainment technology and subliminal programming. You know, if I've got a gun and an iPhone and the iPhone has me completely entrained and brainwashed, then I'm going to give up my gun. I'm going to give up my money. So you need to remember that, because the gun can only protect you in a certain amount of circumstances and not everything. And it's been very interesting to me to see. I left Washington and I said, if there's one issue worth dying for, it's the right to carry a firearm. And, you know, then I did these radio shows in California and ended up meeting lots and lots of lovely people from California who thought gun control was a wonderful thing. And it's been very interesting to see them slowly realize, oh, you know, I don't want gun control. Gun control is a very dangerous thing. And it's quite amazing.
No, so, because they're not talking about taking the guns away from the government.
Right. They're not talking about taking the guns away from the government. They're not talking about taking the guns away from the criminals. They're talking about taking the guns away from the honest people. I live in a state where 50% of the voting population is now permitted to carry a gun. So,
is that Tennessee?
Tennessee.
Uh-huh.
So according to the Tennessee Firearms Association, if you look at voters who turn out to vote, if you look at that number, not registered voters, but people who really show up and vote, their membership is more than 50% of that group. Yeah. So that's very good news.
As an aside, you mentioned the Colorado shooter. I guess mm-hmm. that was the theater shooter, the Joker thing.
Mm-hmm.
Who was his father?
His father is a software developer with software and databases dealing with scoring issues. And I believe it's also dealing with the LIBOR settings and things like that. So this is a guy who's got a very powerful, sensitive position in a quiet kind of way. And the fact that his son, who's a very gifted, talented, very nonviolent person, should suddenly show up in this context, you know, the whole thing stinks.
Right.
There's no way this kid voluntarily did this. Now, if you look at that shooting, it's like all these other shootings. There's no way it was done by one shooter, and certainly not someone who's not a professional. So whatever they did to set this kid up, or, you know, who knows what the story is, you know, but the whole story doesn't make any sense.
And of course, if you see his eyes, if you look at his eyes in pictures, he looks like he's drugged.
It's inconceivable to me that he's not drugged. But it's also inconceivable to me that he's not in shock. Because you take someone who's a lovely, brilliant kid who's living a normal middle-class American life, who then suddenly goes down the rabbit hole and wakes up to find himself accused of this. You know, that's a pretty shocking place to be.
Boy, I'll say.
Yeah. As a friend of mine once said, when the boys want to do you. And, you know, all of America looks at that and they're all terrified. Because nobody wants to, you know, nobody wants to walk in his shoes. And that's the terrifying thing to a business or government leader, because they can literally, and this is why I always refer to the movie Enemy of the State, you know, one day you've spent your whole life being a hardworking, honorable person who's lent money to your family and given, and you're wealthy, you're successful, your credentials are impeccable. You live a clean life. You live an open life. Not perfect. Everybody's human. And suddenly you wake up and everybody says you're a criminal. And you're like, well, wait a minute. I'll never forget, the papers were pounding on saying that I was laundering money. So I had set up Hamilton where all the financial statements were available. All the employees who'd been with us for a certain time were our shareholders. They all had copies to our monthly cash flow statements and financials. The chief financial officer was an unbelievably fantastic, high-quality professional. And all checks had to be signed by two people. And I never signed anything. Okay. So this lovely chief financial officer came up to me and he said, you know, I got up this morning and I thought, well, maybe she is laundering money. And then I realized, if you're laundering money, I would have to be affecting the transactions. And I know I'm not laundering money, so you can't be laundering money because I control and operate all the money and I see everything. And I have to sign, I'm one of those signatures on all the checks. And I know you're not laundering money. You can't without me helping you. So you must not be. But I woke up this morning and thought, well, maybe she is. But how could I be thinking that? Because, you know, and that's how powerful the technology is, the media is. It's unbelievable. Your own family thinks you're an axe murderer. You know, it was unbelievable. One of my favorite stories is, you know, because the question is, how did they get to you? So I'm sitting doing litigation, and I had lent or given family and friends several $100,000. And I had just a fantastic uncle who said, you know, she helped everybody, so I'll help her. And so he bought my family antiques. He bought my farmland in New Hampshire, so he sort of bought the family assets, so we wanted to keep him in the family. But then he lent and gifted me money. And if it wasn't for him, I'd be dead. And my brother is the dean of the law school at the University of Pennsylvania. And my brother and I don't speak. And the reason we don't speak is I don't think he believes in the law. He teaches the law, but he doesn't believe in it. And so I had been writing articles that were giving a very hard time to Harvard University because their endowment, as far as I'm concerned, is a criminal syndicate. And so I'm giving them a hard time about the rape of Russia and the housing bubble and all this stuff that they're involved in, and Enron. And so I kept getting letters from the University of Pennsylvania asking me for donations. And I've raised a lot of money for the University of Pennsylvania. I've given them a fair amount of money personally. And so I had graduated from Penn, BA, and then gotten my MBA at Wharton. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to give Harvard a hard time, I have an obligation before I donate money to Penn to at least look at their financials. And in America, any kind of not-for-profit files annual reports with the IRS. And the last 3 years of reports are required by law to be given to anybody who asks for them. And you know a not-for-profit is really well-run if you go to their website and they have 3 years of the IRS statements right there. You know, that's transparency. So I decided, okay, well, you know, if Penn's going to ask me for money, I should at least look and see where the money's going. So I write to Penn and say, can you please send me 3 years of your IRS filings? So I don't get anything. So I have my attorney write another letter saying, could you please send three? I get a call from a relative who's gotten a call from my brother, the dean of law school at Penn. And this relative claims, my brother got called into the provost office and threatened that if I don't cease and desist, he'll be fired. This is law school, right? So this is the person who's training our lawyers for the future. So this relative says, if you don't cease and desist, I will call your uncle and make sure he stops supporting you and you will fail and go to prison and everything else.
Who said this to you?
This is a relative who is intermediary.
I see.
At that point, Penn sent me one more year. They never sent me the 3 years. So I ceased and desist. I said, you know, I had wanted to know this because I didn't want to give a donation. But there's a very simple solution. I'm never going to donate another dime to Penn for the rest of my life. But that's how tight things are. Now, did the provost really say that to my brother? That's what my brother said. I don't trust him. So, you know, did he exaggerate? Easily, possibly. You know, could the provost have said that? Yes, possibly.
But you never got three financial statements for 3 years.
I never got three financial statements, and that's a violation of the law. They're required by law to give me three copies. But that's how tight things are, and that's how scared people are. That's scared. That's really scared.
Yeah, and you have to wonder about what's going on at Penn.
You know, my guess is that Penn is the same as any big Ivy League university in terms of the model. You have an endowment, which is significant, and it's investing in all the things that are going on. You have a government that's very dependent on government contracts. And you have literally a lot of covert operations that were moved out of the Masonic temples and into the university. Yeah, so all those meetings go on when everybody goes. Everybody comes to the football game. Perfect cover to have all those meetings. And that's why the Penn State scandal is so scary for everybody. Because, you know, you dig into the Penn State scandal and you start to look at, what's happening when everybody gets together to go to the football games at the university?
Oh, wasn't that something? Now, you're talking about the University of Pennsylvania, not Penn State.
I'm talking about a model.
No, I know, but I mean the story about your brother and where you went to school, that was University of Pennsylvania.
Right.
But Penn State is where the sex scandal was. That's
right.
A different
Right,
different
but if you
school.
Look at the model of what's going on,
yeah,
it's the same. The model is the same everywhere. So let me explain it this way. Let's say I'm running an investment syndicate, okay? And let's say that investment syndicate has overt operations and covert operations, but it's making a lot of money. If I run it as an investment business, then it has to pay taxes. But if I put it in a university or church endowment, then it doesn't have to pay taxes. So let's say if I ran it as a for-profit, it would have to pay 20% a year in taxes on its gains. Okay, and on its interest. So it has current income and it has capital gains. So let's say on average it would have to pay 20%. Well, why not put it in a not-for-profit endowment? It doesn't have to pay the 20%. Then we take 5% every year and we use it to fund a university. And that university brings up the young, brightest, and best people and sends them into our operations where we want them to go. And then it produces lots of policies and studies that justify the policies we want. So if you look at the Harvard Watch study on Enron, you know, Harvard was being paid all sorts of money to come up with studies that, you know, that justified the changes in government policy that would make Enron money. Okay, so rather than paying 20% in taxes, we pay a 5% tax, but we pay a 5% tax to create intellectual air cover and human capital for our investment syndicate. So when I look at a university, I don't see a school. I see an investment syndicate that is a tax shelter that is using the money, a portion of the money that they would pay in taxes instead, to build up the human capital and the intellectual capital they need to build up their investment syndicate. Okay? You know, so I look at those places and I see an investment syndicate. I don't see a school. A university is not a university. It's something else. It's a way to manage, gather, and manage power in a variety of ways that is unbelievably cost-effective. And that's why if you look at how the endowments are run, they're run with self-perpetuating boards. But again, if Mr. Global has the power to kill with impunity, what are those boards going to do? They're going to do whatever they're told, just like that chairman of CalPERS.
Now, when you make a donation to an endowment at a university, that donation, you don't have to pay tax on the money yourself if you make that donation?
Right. You get a deduction for that donation, and that donation either goes to pay for the cost of the university or it goes into the endowment, which builds up the investment syndicate.
I see. And the endowment only has to pay 5%?
Usually, an endowment will set a certain percent so that the endowment is valued at the end of the year, and then a certain percent is set aside for the university. The endowment model, there's a great video where Ed Griffin interviews Norm Dodd about the foundations before Norm Dodd died. It's a wonderful video. It's up on the internet, and it goes into this model. Let's, you know, look at the Vatican. They have combined that model with 2,000 years of a global diplomatic immunity and tax exemption.
Yes. They don't have to pay property taxes on their properties, do
right.
they?
So think about what you can do in terms of the compounding the value of your endowment over 2,000 years. 2,000 years of diplomatic immunity, tax exemption, and a foundation model where you can compound your capital in this way. It's an amazing, amazing model. And to think that $40 trillion probably just got added to it.
Now, what is the video you talked about? That's important to know.
Ed Griffin interviewing Norm Dodd. On the Solari Report, John Rappaport and I did top 10 movies and top 10 documentaries, and that's one of the ones listed as the top 10 documentaries. Absolutely fantastic.
Is this on the homepage at Solari.com?
Log into the Solari Report and then just go into the archive. Or once you're logged into a search for top 10 documentaries, and all the links are up in that section.
I think that's an important thing to watch. Is it up on YouTube, too?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
If you do a search for and Norm Dodd, you'll get it. And Texas and Foundations.
And how long is it?
I think it's about an hour and a half. It's long. But it's, oh, when I tell you, it's meaty and deeply satisfying.
No, it's a good thing to watch. Because I don't understand how that model works myself. I'd like to watch that.
You just have to look at the math. Mm-hmm. You just have to look at the math. You could do it with an Excel spreadsheet where you say, okay, these guys are for profit and they pay on average, you know, 10 or 20% a year. And these guys are not for profit. And instead of paying 10 or 20%, they put 5% into this intellectual capital and human capital operation that feeds them the best people and all sorts of intellectual air cover to get whatever policy they want passed. You know, and with something like the Vatican, throw in diplomatic immunity. And you know something? The first team doesn't have a chance. They don't have a chance.